And welcome, beloved listeners, to the Little Wireless program. Doctrines abound. Every religion has a doctrine or doctrines. The Hindus, the Jains, the Buddhists all have doctrines, and Christianity, of course, abounds with them. The doctrine of the Trinity, virgin birth, original sin, and there are military doctrines, and there are political doctrines. Some that come to my mind are the Monroe Doctrine, the Brezhnev Doctrine, the Reagan Doctrine, and tonight a new doctrine has entered political parlance in the United States, and that's the Hillary Doctrine. And in just a minute, we'll be going to, of all places, Niagara Falls, to talk to Corinne Mason, who's been writing very interesting stuff on, yes, the Hillary Doctrine. And then I'm going to be talking to you about cigarettes, and particularly cigars. Now, I'm going to make a confession here. I love smoking. I had to give it up, of course, like everyone else, although once in a while I do have a furtive rolly. It's a great shame. It's a great shame that it's bad for you, because it is, in many ways, a very delicious habit. But I'm fascinated. I've never been into cigars. I always found those a bit over the top. But I have a very vivid memory of one of the most remarkable cigar smokers ever. And, you know, let's admit to this, that amongst the devotees, we had everyone from Groucho Marx to Churchill, and quite notoriously in more recent times, there's Clinton and his cigar. I'm talking about a fellow called Lou Grade, Lord Grade, affectionately known as Low Grade Lou. And Lou dominated the British film industry and much of its television until he made a very serious mistake. He decided to make a film called Raise the Titanic, and it sank him. It was such a disaster. But in happier times, Lou and I would wander through London in the mornings, and we'd head along Jermyn Street to Davidoff, which was the most famous tobacconist in town, I suppose, next to Dunhill. And Lou would go in, I'd go in and buy a packet of their fine cigarettes, but Lou would get two or three cigars, his daily diet of Cuban cigars, 40 or 50 quid each. Now, that was a pleasure that not even an American president could have legally, because if anyone in the United States was caught smoking a Cuban cigar, they could well finish up in Cuba, incarcerated in Guantanamo. But we're going to talk about the significance and the symbolism of the cigar a little later in the program with a guest who hasn't been on for almost 20 years, but I remember him vividly, a very amusing fellow. And but first of all, as promised, the Hillary Doctrine. Now, Hillary Clinton's tenure as Secretary for State between 2009 and 2013 gave rise to a new narrative coupling of women's rights and violence against women with national security in the US agenda. The Hillary Doctrine, as it's now called, says that where women suffer abuse, nations are likely to be unstable, instability begets extremism, and to study this deceptively elegant proposition, we're joined from Niagara Falls by Corinne L. Mason, who's assistant professor in gender studies at Brandon University. I have to ask you first, Corinne, why are you not speaking to me from Ontario?
Thanks for having me this morning. I'm in Niagara Falls at an academic conference, so I'm outside of Manitoba, but I'm very happy to be in Niagara Falls, I have to say.
Okay. Now, in recent years, that connection between security in terms of foreign policy and development and the guise of social welfare issues has become quite close, hasn't it?
Absolutely, it has. I think especially in the post-9/11 moment, we've seen quite a coupling of national security agendas with a variety of other kind of, as you say, welfare agendas, including development.
And after 9/11, the perceived belligerence of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the U.S. has since taken steps to renovate its image and legitimate campaigns in new ways. And one way in which they've attempted to do so is by this coupling of development and national security.
Absolutely. So what I found in my research is that the U.S. has spent quite a bit of time reformulating its foreign policy objectives and really thinking about the ways that it presents its national security agenda by bringing on more moral or innocent issues such as violence against women into the fold. It's very hard to disagree with caring about violence against women at the national and international level. So we see the issues like violence against women or gender equality more general being brought into national security objectives.
And you and I are having this conversation at a time when the world news resonates with horror stories about women being stoned to death and, terrible, terrible stories. Okay. Now, why the Hillary Doctrine?
It's interesting because I came across the Hillary Doctrine after seeing a newspaper article about how Hillary was in Papua New Guinea, and a Secretary of State for the U.S. had not been in Papua New Guinea for quite a while, and this news article was suggesting that that Hillary was there because they were unveiling an ExxonMobil project, which was worth, I think, $15 million, something astronomical. And at the same time as she's in Papua New Guinea revealing this ExxonMobil project, she's also promoting ending a culture of violence against women in Papua New Guinea and trying to make the connection between doing this kind of investment work while also doing this anti-violence work at the same time. And I thought, this is something. I'm not sure what this is. I really want to know more about it. And I came across the Hillary Doctrine in a Newsweek article in 2011.
Yes, as the phrase, it was coined by a Gail Lemon for
yes.
Newsweek, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Okay, now one could point out that violence against women is a huge social problem in my affluent nation and indeed, of course, in the United States of America. The land of Hillary's birth, but nonetheless, let's push on with seeing this in a more panoramic and global sense. You quote a dark assumption, quote, when individuals are unable to cope with or adjust to underdevelopment, they pose a risk to the West and this threat must be contained. Now, this made the war on terror a civilizing mission.
Absolutely. So that quote actually comes from criticizing the ways in which the underdeveloped world is understood to be particularly risky. So what I'm trying to do in my research is show that when we couple security with development agendas, what we see is that impoverished nations are not understood necessarily or only to be about thinking about humanitarian action or benevolence or intervening to better economies in other spaces, but rather that these are risky people and there are risky bodies and they're actually threats to national security if we don't do the work of doing development.
Okay, two linked questions. Tell us about the International Violence Against Women Act and how did Hillary incorporate it into her policy objectives, Corinne?
Right, so the International Violence Against Women Act was originally introduced to Congress in 2010. It's been reintroduced twice now. It sits inactive, so it's failed twice, but remains active insofar as women's organizations in the U.S. and transnationally are really pushing for the International Violence Against Women Act to be passed in Congress. And it's supported by Secretary of State John Kerry, so the potential for it to pass in the future is potentially high. What the International Violence Against Women Act would do would be to legislate intervening in other countries by the U.S. on the basis of violence against women. So it would really target other countries as particularly violent and having a high case of violence against women and then legislative interventions on that basis.
I'm talking to Corinne L. Mason, and our subject is the Hillary Doctrine, LNL, on RN. It's some aspects of this smack of tokenism. The Violence Against Women Act outlined the establishment of a new Secretary's Office of Global Women's Issues within the U.S. State Department, but it was funded with a miserable $10 million for each fiscal between 2011 and 2015. Not much money to carry out such an ambitious program.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's interesting to see the ways in which the United States, and specifically the Obama administration, has really taken on this issue of gender equality and violence against women in particular in its kind of rhetoric, but that hasn't really followed through necessarily on investment strategies. But we have seen the Obama administration sign things like memorandums in 2013, which established a White House Council on Women and Girls. We have the first ever ambassador at large for women's global issues in the United States. So we see this at least discursively or within the level of like policy documentation, signing memorandums, a real focus on violence against women and gender equality. But you're right to point out that the money might not necessarily be there.
Now, this is where one feels a tiny bit of suspicion. According to the Act, only eligible countries will be subject to it. And eligibility is based on the most current World Development Report published by the World Bank, which means, I assume, the US can pursue its moral mission selectively.
Absolutely. This is exactly what it means. And I found this to be one of the most interesting part of the International Violence Against Women Act that hasn't gotten very much attention. So the fact that this legislation would only target countries that are understood to be low income means that higher income countries, including Canada, where I am living and working, would not be subject to this act. And I think it's really important to think through the implications of this, because in Canada, we have an epidemic of missing and murdered Aboriginal women. And this International Violence Against Women Act would not allow for interventions into these very systemic issues in higher income countries.
Exactly the same situation in Australia, both in regard to Indigenous women and, of course, to women living in the affluent suburbs of Melbourne and Sydney.
Absolutely. And I think what's happening in the United States right now with Elliot Rodger, I'm not sure how familiar Australians are with this issue. I imagine it's getting quite global media, is that we know that violence against women and gender inequality is not resolved in these high-income countries. So it is very suspicious that we're only focusing on those countries deemed eligible based on being lower income.
We've been doing some programs on Boko Haram and the kidnapping of those hundreds of girls in Nigeria. I presume a country like Nigeria would qualify.
Absolutely. So Nigeria would likely be understood as a lower income country. But the other part of the International Violence Against Women Act that's really important to note is that it not only deems a country eligible by their income, it also suggests that it has to fit within U.S. security and development objectives. So it has to be in the interest of U.S. foreign policy and specifically national security objectives to actually intervene. So this gets quite a vague and broad way of thinking about eligibility, which means this is really about geopolitical interests in certain countries above others.
This is Lynn LNL on RN and bouncing around the world as well. And my guest is Corinne L. Mason, Assistant Professor in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies at Brandon University. And Corinne wrote a substantial academic article last year titled Global Violence Against Women as National Security Emergency. And we're discussing matters arising. You use an intriguing term, gender wash. What's gender wash?
So gender washing, for me, is the ways in which imperial projects of empire, U.S. And other foreign policy objectives, such as national security, become obscured or changed or simplified by adding gender equality into the equation. So what we see is that these projects, which are highly suspicious, that we should be taking quite seriously, look very innocent and look very moral, look often benevolent when we add gender equality to the issue. So what I'm trying to do with this term gender washing is to think through the ways in which the U.S. in particular presents itself as exceptional on the issue of gender equality.
You make one point. Abroad. You make one point that gender washing is perhaps the case with the inclusion of women in the military. You find this more suspicious than empowering.
Absolutely. So I think that the military itself is inherently a violent institution, and when we ask the military to respond to violence against women, we really ignore the ways in which there is extreme forms and systemic forms of violence against women with the U.S. military itself. So inviting women into a particularly masculinist organization that has a culture of violence against women within its own ranks is a gender washing mechanism. So in my research, I looked at how many sexual assaults there have been over the time that the Hillary Doctrine was really circulating when she was the Secretary of State. And the Pentagon released a report in 2013, which suggested that there was as many as 26,000 sexual assaults in 2012 alone. So we know that there's
you quote Jane Harman, a U.S. representative, saying women serving in the U.S. military are more likely to be raped by a fellow soldier than killed by enemy fire in Iraq. And in the case of sexual assault and rape, the enemy eats across the table at the mess hall, shares a vehicle on patrol.
Absolutely. And I think what that kind of what this does is really allows the U.S. to obscure its own culture of violence against women nationally. So when the U.S. does this work of exporting its expertise in ending violence against women, this really gender washes the ways in which violence against women is not resolved in the United States. And when we rely on national security objectives and therefore securitized responses or military responses to places that are deemed to be risky and unstable because of this high culture of violence against women, the U.S. Really obscures what's happening at home.
I don't want to dwell on the U.S. military, but you quote a major in a recent paper of yours saying, quote, the defining role of any military force is the management of violence by violence. And, of course, in that context, the point is that women in the military serve to soften the PR rather than really profoundly affect or modify masculine military culture.
Absolutely. So I think what we do when we talk about quotas in particularly masculinist organizations such as the military by bringing women in or having this kind of hiring legislation to bring more women into the military, what we're not asking about or what we're not actually doing is changing the culture of the military itself. So it's not just enough to add more women in STIR. It's that I think we need to think through what kinds of military masculinities or masculinist culture, and specifically cultures of violence, are inherent to the military itself. And I'm not sure that adding more women into these masculinist spaces will do the work of softening or changing these spaces necessarily.
A glaring mark against the Hillary Doctrine is therefore that it positions the U.S. as a moral arbiter that has overcome gender equality. It's rather like the nonsense that we heard after the election of Obama, that the issue of race had been was over. In that sense, is the Hillary Doctrine a kind of national self-deception?
I think in a lot of ways it might be, but I also think it's really important to credit Hillary Clinton for putting an issue like gender equality and violence against women domestically and internationally on a national agenda. So as much as I'm critical of the Hillary Doctrine and specifically the way that it functions through geopolitical power, I'm also very invested in Hillary Clinton as a feminist who is excited by what Hillary Clinton has done in the national context as the Secretary of State.
One of my favorite quotes is T.S. Eliot, between the ideal and the reality falls the shadow. And that's true across every sphere of human activity. And I can see what you're getting at. It's one thing to have it's terribly important that we have these ambit claims or these ideals that we pursue, even if they turn out to be as elusive as the rainbow. Did it attract bipartisan support? Because one reads constant horror stories about the appalling hostility to women amongst, well, the Tea Party and the Republican right.
Right. So the International Violence Against Women Act has received bipartisan support every time it's been introduced into Congress. And I think this really suggests the ways in which violence against women gets tied to both Democratic and Republican leanings, insofar as it gets connected to national security objectives. And we know that, especially in the Bush era, the Republican Party was particularly concerned with Afghan women, for example, in this kind of interventionist strategy into Afghanistan. So we see the same kind of things happening with the International Violence Against Women Act, even though I think it has quite liberal leanings.
You must have been quite pleased, I hope, when Michelle Obama dedicated that weekly address of hers to the mass abduction of the girls in Nigeria. So it has become absolutely mainstream politics. Is Hillary talking about it as she prepares her own presidential run?
That's really interesting. I think what we're seeing right now with Hillary Clinton, especially because her memoir is coming out, or she's got a memoir called Hard Choices that's coming out in June. I'm not exactly sure what's in it, but I imagine that a lot of it will be about her run as Secretary of State and the kinds of things that she wanted to do in this time. And I think because she was so wonderfully apt at getting violence against women and gender equality onto national foreign policy objectives, we might actually see this as part of her campaign run. That being said, people are so focused on Hillary Clinton's love life still, her scrunchies, her pantsuits, and all the ways in which we see this kind of sexist media representation. So I'm not 100% sure that she'll focus so much on gender equality and violence against women as she's trying to fight these really sexist representations of her presidential run.
Of course, she may have a challenger within the Democrats in Elizabeth Warren, but Warren, it seems to me, just as progressive, if not more so than Hillary on these issues.
Right. And we're actually seeing, I think, a little bit of media backlash against Hillary Clinton, and especially her age. So often the media is suggesting that she's too old to take this on, even though we know that there have been presidents who have been older than her in the past. And I think this really speaks to just sexist media representations around Hillary Clinton and the kind of distrust that people have for a woman to run for a presidential candidacy. And Michelle Warren, I'm sure, will face different but quite similar backlash against her presidential campaign.
Look, thanks very much for your time, Corinne. Corinne L. Mason, Assistant Professor in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies at Brandon University. And you can find a link to that paper on our website.